Radio Boston, I'm Tiziana Deering. You can buy e-cigarettes in Massachusetts again. Because today the State Public Health Council met about noon to lift the temporary ban on the sale of nicotine vapes and put some new regulations in place. WBUR reporter Angus Chen was there. Welcome, Angus.
Thanks, Tiziana. Great to be here.
So we know the headlines, so put us in the room. Most people can't go to a meeting like this. Put us in the room at noon today.
Yeah, so there was a bunch of officials there with the Public Health Council, and it was really business as usual. They kind of wanted, it almost felt like they kind of wanted to move through this really quickly. It was the last thing on the agenda today, and they were starting to run a little over time, and very quickly the Health Council voted to lift the ban that Governor Baker had put in place on September 24th, and then health officials came forward to give a presentation on proposed regulations that the council was about to vote on.
So what did they pass?
There's just a couple of takeaways from these regulations, mainly convenience stores, gas stations, those types of basic kind of your normal stores that sell vapes or e-cigarettes have to move all these products behind the counter, and they cannot sell anything that has a nicotine concentration of greater than 35 milligrams of nicotine per milliliter of vape liquid. Anything higher than that has to be in a 21-plus store, so that would be like your Juuls. And the last thing is that shops that sell e-cigarettes need to post signage saying, hey, e-cigarettes are dangerous, and the Department of Health recommends that you don't use them.
Did you hear anything from the head of the Department of Health or from the State Public Health Commissioner herself on this?
Yeah, you know, after the meeting, Monica Burrell, the state health commissioner, came forward to say that, you know, her position is just that even though e-cigarettes are back on sale, they don't know if these things are safe, and they don't think anybody should be using them. Here's the state public health commissioner, Monica Burrell.
E-cigarettes and vaping products are relatively new to our market. They've been only in place since about 2007. There is no long-term efficacy studies done related to them. This summer, as we saw these lung-related injuries, it pointed to the fact that we do not know these products to be safe, and we cannot recommend that individuals use them.
So Governor Baker originally said he put this ban in place because he felt health officials needed more time just to figure out what was causing these vape-related lung injuries. But here's Monica Burrell again.
I need to be clear that there is associations that have been made, but the cause of these e-cigarette and vaping-associated lung injuries is not known in Massachusetts or nationally at this time.
So health officials are basically just hoping these regulations are going to be enough to protect people and let adults make up their own minds about the risks of using e-cigarettes and vape products.
Okay, but there was a law passed in November, so it's not like everything goes back to the way it was in September before the emergency ban. What can you and can't you buy now in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts today and going forward?
Yeah, so before, you could pretty much buy any kind of e-cigarette at any sort of store, if you're 21 or older. But now you cannot buy any flavored e-cigarette in any retail store in Massachusetts anymore. If you want that, you have to go to a smoking bar where you can still purchase flavored e-cigarettes, but you have to consume them on site, so you can't take them home. If you want to go to a regular store, like a convenience store that is selling vapes, you can purchase anything that is unflavored or tobacco-flavored that has a lower concentration of nicotine, so less than 35 milligrams of nicotine per milliliter of vape liquid. And if you want a Juul pod or something stronger than that, you have to go to a 21-plus store. The law that you referenced that Governor Baker signed, it also affects flavored tobacco products. So that's like chewing tobacco and menthol cigarettes.
You can still, cigars.
Flavored cigars, exactly. So you can still buy those things in places where you used to buy them, but they'll be phased out over pretty much like the next 6 months. By, I think, June 2020 is when they'll be restricted to just smoking bars like flavored e-cigarettes.
People will not necessarily give these products up easily, Angus, and businesses have had incentives to sell them. So what kind of enforcement's in place now?
Yeah, so the Department of Public Health is empowered to do inspections of stores that are selling vapes and e-cigarettes. And if they find that anyone is not complying with these regulations, they have a fine schedule in place. The first time a store is in violation of the regulations, they get fined $1,000. They can also be shut down for business, or they can be prohibited from selling e-cigarettes basically for a period of maybe like up to a week. The second time, it's $2,000 of a fine, and again, time. And then the third time is $5,000. So
and just to be
up.
So just to be clear, Angus, none of this applies to cannabis. That is separately regulated by the Cannabis Control Commission, and they have a moratorium on such sales right now, correct?
That's correct. So the Cannabis Control Commission has put a hold on any sales of marijuana vape products, with the exception of flower vapes. So these are basically like little ovens that you can stuff with marijuana bud, and it heats up. But anything that's like a vape liquid that contains THC is still under that moratorium.
All right. WBUR reporter Angus Chen, thanks very much.
Thanks.
So that statewide emergency ban on vaping sales is lifted. But if you recall back in September when it went into place, businesses who sold vaping products were dismayed. They were really worried about the impact on them. So today, WBUR Bostonomics reporter Zanindra Enwemeka is actually at a shop. It's Fast Eddie's Smoke Shop right down the street in Alston. They sell vaping products. Zanindra, hello.
Hi.
So Zanindra, we want to find out how businesses are doing now that it's lifted. Is the store open right now? And, you know, what's the action like there?
Yeah, so the store is open right now. I'm actually in the store. It's a bit quieter now, but I'm told that it was pretty busy earlier on. Customers were coming in looking to buy vaping products now that the ban is lifted. So it was a bit busy earlier on. Now it's quieted down some, but, you know, they are expecting customers to be returning. I will say, you know, the folks who run the shop here, there's still some frustration about some of the limitations and the restrictions with the regulations, as Angus just explained. And so, you know, they're open and, you know, their customers are coming through.
So this is one store, Fast Eddie's Smoke Shop. Of course, vaping products are being sold now all over the Commonwealth. What's the reaction to the lift of the ban? And can you tell us a little more about the restrictions that they're chafing against?
Yeah. So, I mean, many business owners are feeling bittersweet. On the one hand, they're glad that the ban has been lifted. But again, they're still limited in what they can sell. And, you know, it's important to point out that for many businesses, the flavored vaping products were really a huge draw for customers and a big part of their sales. I've been speaking to some of those business owners this week as they prepared for the end of the ban. I spoke with Stacy Peritsky, who is the co-owner of Vape Daddies in Newton. We spoke yesterday. And, you know, that store, they had to close two of their four locations because of the ban.
We're glad that the ban is being lifted partially, but it's not like, woohoo, the ban's been lifted, because we can't sell the biggest piece of our business anymore, which was flavored juices. And the people that are hurt are consumers who have chosen to vape because it's a safer alternative.
Yeah, and Peritsky told me that 90% of their vape sales were flavored vape products. And now with the new regulations, they can only sell tobacco-flavored or unflavored nicotine products.
So in addition to not being able to sell all the products they could before, the businesses were shut down really in effect, or at least that portion of the business, for 3 months. Zanindra, what did they do during that time to try to stay alive?
Yeah, well, some stores had to close down. They just weren't making any sales because of the ban, and they couldn't stay open. For the stores that are open now, many of them are still sitting on inventory that they're likely going to have to throw out. There are expiration dates on these items. I should note that there are some business owners were able to sell some of their inventory online to out-of-state customers, particularly vape shops in other states. And some owners told me that they were able to return some products to manufacturers. Here's Pete Patel, who owns Liquid Smoke and Vape Shop in Alston.
We sent it back to some companies who take back that inventory, and some we sold out of state for really just cheap price. We still have a lot, like 30% inventory left over from juice and all the stuff. And at least it's good because we can sell the vape device and all those stuff. So we might not total loss, but we can save a little bit, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so Patel says he's now focused more on tobacco products, also glass products like pipes and hookah, basically everything but vape products.
Zanindra, I know we're, you know, kind of at day one here, but any sense what percentage of businesses survived?
Yeah, that's really unclear right now. I mean, we do know that several shops have closed, but we don't have an exact number at this time. I should note, though, that the Baker administration had previously estimated that the ban would potentially cost businesses up to $8 million in sales.
Tell us about the lawsuit, Zeninger, that some businesses have filed.
Yeah, that lawsuit is ongoing, and these businesses have lost money, and they are still seeking damages for that period of the ban. I spoke with Craig Rourke about this. He's an attorney who is representing the vape shops that sued over the ban. And here's what he says about how his clients are thinking about this now.
Now that we've sort of come to a bit of a conclusion on the ban, the new law, we've been able to measure the damages. I mean, I think that they're, hopeful that to some extent the businesses that they spent all these years trying to build, can, survive in a new fashion.
Things have sounded lively in the background there, Zeninger. Where do things go from here for these businesses?
Yeah, well, vape shops are selling again today. They're focusing on tobacco, or some of them, as I mentioned, are trying to offer different types of items and products, and they're hoping that that will be enough to keep their shops going.
That is WBUR Bostonomics reporter Zeninger Enwemeka. Zeninger, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Do you realize the New Hampshire primary is 9 weeks away? It sounds like it could be a close one. According to a new WBUR poll that's out today, South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg and former Vice President Joe Biden are leading narrowly a crowded field of Democrats. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks is here to talk about it. Welcome back, Anthony.
Hi, Tiziana.
Okay, so it sounds like Buttigieg's leading the field, but just barely. What do you know? Can you break it down?
Yeah, I mean, this is really a four-person race. I mean, we've got these figures, Buttigieg at 18, Joe Biden at 17, Bernie Sanders at 15, Elizabeth Warren at 12. But you've got to consider the margin of error. You've got to consider 20%, nearly 20% of New Hampshire voters, primary voters, Democratic primary voters, say they haven't made up their mind. This race is a toss-up. It really is. And I'm impressed by Buttigieg's strength. I'm also impressed by Biden's strength. Yes, Elizabeth Warren has slipped, but she's very much still in the race. This could go any direction here on out. In New Hampshire, the New Hampshire primary, Tiziana, as you know, always is full of surprises. It often offers surprises. So what this poll says more than anything is this race is up in the air.
Feels like the March Madness of elections.
A little
this
bit,
time.
Yeah.
So one of the things that does strike me, I'm a big fan of which of these things is not like the others.
Right.
So if you list Warren, Sanders, Biden, Buttigieg, Buttigieg is younger, less well-known, less political experience. What do you think? Why is he getting traction right now?
Well, I think that's a great question. And he's a moderate, so he's appealing to voters who might be concerned about the party drifting too much to the left. Maybe there is concern about Warren's Medicare for All plan, for example. Buttigieg talks about a more moderate Medicare for All who want it plan. When I talked to him earlier this week, he said we can do a lot of big things, but what he's proposing, what he doesn't want to do is offer the kind of divisiveness that he thinks could sort of detonate more divisiveness in the Democratic Party. That seems to be appealing to people. He's also a very sort of calming figure. He's a smart figure. When you go to his rallies, people are very impressed with his level of preparation, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
So here's Leslie Ring of Bow, New Hampshire, who, by the way, says she loves Elizabeth Warren, everything about her. She said, I love everything about Elizabeth Warren, except one key issue. She's concerned that she's not electable, that she might be too divisive. So she's decided to back Buttigieg. Here's what she said.
I think he brings people together. I think he incorporates religion and policy and intellect. He is hopeful and he makes you feel hopeful, especially now. I think that's really important.
So that gives us a little look at Buttigieg, at Warren, but let's talk about Biden, who it seems like, Anthony, at least some people were sort of declaring his demise weeks ago after some shaky debate performances and gaffes.
Yeah, really. I mean, reports of his demise were premature, it seems. Yeah, so I was struck by these figures. I mean, he's right behind Buttigieg in our poll. Not long ago, there was talk that he was pretty much giving up on New Hampshire, but according to our poll, he's right back in contention. And here's something super interesting, Tiziana. I was just looking at his polling averages, his national polling average. Now, I know, you know, these races are decided state by state, but the national figures tell you something. December 2018, he was polling at 31%, okay, nationally. December 2019, 31%.
Who does that sound like?
Yeah. Well, who are you thinking?
I'm thinking Donald Trump.
Well,
kind of this unwavering, constant support.
Yeah. Well, to me, it reminds me of the 2012 Republican primary, where you had that's when Mitt Romney was elected, and the first three contests were decided by three different people. Mitt Romney won New Hampshire, but lost South Carolina. Santorum won Iowa.
Well, there's a name I haven't heard in a while.
And right, and I'm trying to remember who won South Carolina, but it wasn't Mitt Romney. So three different people won the first week. But you sort of cycled through all of these extra players, but the sort of party establishment figure Mitt Romney sort of came back in the end and won. That's not a prediction about Biden. I'm just saying, I think he was counted out too soon.
And do you think it's his establishment appeal, actually, that might be bringing him back?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I think he's sort of, look, I think one of the interesting sort of subtexts of our poll is you could sort of talk about this as revenge of the moderates, if you will. You know, there's been a lot of attention focused on Elizabeth Warren, of course, Bernie Sanders, who carried New Hampshire in the last New Hampshire primary. Elizabeth Warren has been ascendant until recently. Now comes this poll that sort of says, well, wait a minute, we're sort of putting the brakes on this rush toward the progressives, and there seems to be an embrace of the moderates. So here's Dave Elderkin of Concord, who says he's leaning toward Joe Biden because he believes he's got the best chance of beating President Trump. Here's what he said.
You need somebody that's in the center. I'm a very moderate, pragmatic kind of person and realize you can't be in either extreme. He also has the experience.
So one of the things, okay, we just heard this quote, right? And earlier you talked about the fact that in this poll, when voters are first asked how they would vote, 20%. Say yeah. That they have still not
19,
made up their minds.
Yeah, almost 20%. Yep.
All right, and you've talked about kind of what this reminds you of from previous primaries. I wonder, so are we fractured, or at the end of the day, as you say, this guy wants Biden because he thinks he can beat Trump? Will voters line up behind a candidate first and foremost to beat the current president of the United States?
I think they will. I mean, I think you hear that again and again from Democratic voters who oppose Trump and independents up in New Hampshire, that they will support the Democrat that they think has the best chance of beating Trump, and that they will support ultimately whoever the candidate is. And I think that's clear because I think, you know, polls tell us that health care is the most important. A lot of people are concerned about climate change, and for very good reason. But none of that stuff is going to be addressed, they feel, with Donald Trump in the White House. So they've got to get Trump out of the White House. So, yes, I do think folks are going to line up. And by the way, one of the reasons why I think we're seeing such a fractured race, I mean, one of the interpretations is that a lot of people really like this group of people. So they're like, yeah, I've got my number one, I've got my number two, I've got my number three, and if not her, then him, and if not him, then her. So I think that's one of the reasons why you're seeing this race. But yes, do I think they will consolidate behind the candidate? Eventually. The question is just when. You know, is it going to be after New Hampshire? Is it going to be after South Carolina? Or is it going to be after Super Tuesday?
So I want to back up for a second, because this voter that you played who said, hey, I love Warren, but I'm worried she's too divisive, so I'm going for Buttigieg. She's on my mind because I'm struggling with it. Okay, so it seems like Buttigieg ascendant means Warren descendant, almost like there's an inverse relationship between the two of them. But it's hard to imagine that what's really happening is people who love a progressive candidate are now swapping for a more moderate one, even though we talked about that a little bit. So how much transfer can there be, and how strong is this really progressive wing now of the Democratic Party who does not want to compromise by becoming more moderate?
Well, it's a great question, and I actually don't know the answer to that. It's a really good question. I mean, what I'm sort of intrigued by is, you know, the upswing for Buttigieg comes as Warren loses support. Does that mean they're necessarily related? Well, clearly they're both competing for highly educated in New Hampshire, white voters. But Warren's sort of pause, in a way, can be explained in other ways. It sort of coincided. It doesn't mean it was caused by it. It coincided with when she rolled out her, her $20 trillion plan for Medicare for all. She started taking incoming from her competitors. Voters probably started to scrutinize her a little bit more. So here's Steve Cazella of the Mass Inc. polling group, who suggests that maybe her slippage had something to do with that.
It was sort of about the time that she rolled out the Medicare for All plan in some detail that her momentum seemed to fade a little bit.
I mean, it's true. Now, correlation doesn't mean causation. Other factors could be, as a front runner, she took fire from other candidates. Maybe because she was in front, voters took another look at her. But there it is. Her numbers are definitely down. And they have been now for the last, a month or so.
All right. So I feel like we have to talk about the looming role that this impeachment inquiry plays in people's considerations. It looks like the poll asked New Hampshire voters about their feelings on impeachment. You know, was it sort of Democrats, yay, Republicans, no? Or
yeah.
Was there anything that stood out to you in those
Well,
numbers?
Pretty much. I mean, voters are divided very evenly along partisan lines. But it seems pretty clear that they've got their minds made up as well. So among likely voters in the Democratic presidential primary, 69% say Trump should be removed from office, while an overwhelming majority of likely voters in the Republican presidential primary, 83%, say that the president should not be removed for office. Now, it's also interesting to me that the overwhelming majority of likely voters in the Republican presidential primary, around 83%, don't think that the president should. No, wait, this isn't the thing that I wanted to, here it is. Trump's favorability rating.
I'm with
you. Okay, so this is what I found really interesting. His favorability rating appears to have taken a hit. In New Hampshire.
Oh, that is interesting.
So the WBUR poll found that 71% of likely Republican primary voters view the president favorably. That's still a pretty good number, but it's down from 85% in October in a poll from CNN and the University of New Hampshire. So it seems like, you know, what we are all enduring in Washington right now is having an effect on the way the president is viewed, even by Republicans.
All right. So we've got about 30 seconds left. And you said earlier, people like all these candidates. We know 20% are undecided. In your experience, you've been covering this for a long time. How are people going to decide? When's the moment we're going to say, yep, I am going to pick X?
Boy, if I knew that, I would probably, you know, have opened up a crystal ball parlor in down the street in Union Square. I don't know. I mean, I get the feeling that we're, you know, this isn't going to be like, oh, my God, candidate X won in Iowa and then took New Hampshire and is on his or her way to South Carolina. And that's where it's going to end. I have a feeling that this is going to go well into Super Tuesday before the party kind of coalesces around a candidate. But that's just a guess.
We will follow the wild ride with you. That is WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, thanks.
My pleasure, as always.
We are revisiting a conversation we had with comedian and actor Rainn Wilson. He's best known for his role as office bully Dwight Schrute in the hit TV show The Office. When he published his memoir, The Bassoon King, My Life in Art, Faith, and Idiocy, in 2015, Wilson stopped by the show to talk about it. And Meghna Chakrabarty started by telling him that she felt his memoir was actually an ode to love.
Wow, an ode to love, like Proust, kind of?
Look, you're a man who quotes Rilke in the first chapter.
Yeah, I do. I have a lot of pretentious quotes in there. That's really interesting. I'm going to think about that, an ode to love. Yeah, there's a lot of exploration in this. You know, when I pitched the book, I said, listen, there's going to be some stuff that's going to be spiritual in here, and I'm going to strive for some profundity, and I've got to share some deep, dark truths about my life and, you know, and a lot of, you know, warts and all kind of stuff and make myself really vulnerable. And there's going to be some big ideas in it. And the publishers weren't scared. So, you know, I don't know that I succeeded, but I swung for the fences on this one because I wanted it to be really funny, but I also wanted it to be as profound as I could make it.
Okay, well, I'd love to sort of share in detail with listeners the sense of that profundity, because I'm sure they're probably sitting here, those people who don't know your story are sitting here thinking, wait, this guy plays Dwight on The Office, and we're talking about profound spirituality, but it's true. So Can you read a little section of your book? Because
sure.
I would love to hear you tell this story. And it has to do when you went to Tufts.
Yep.
And this was a moment of divine inspiration that you had because you weren't quite sure what you wanted to do with your life. But you say that you had a mystical experience when you went to go watch A Chorus Line at a government center multiplex. So can you tell us a little bit of that story and then read to us the moment of divine inspiration?
Yeah, I was trying to decide whether to become an actor or not. And really, like, because I knew, because my dad was a failed artist and he'd wanted to paint and he wanted to write and never worked out for him. I knew that if you wanted to be a professional artist, I didn't know any professional artists, but I imagined that you would have to devote 10, 15, 20 years to it, that you have to dive in completely. And that was a very scary thing for me at 19 years old. And I was trying to decide whether to go to India with my friend who was going to go travel for a year or to go to acting school, maybe go to New York and really like dive into the whole acting thing. I didn't know what to do. And my decision was kind of made for me seeing this matinee of A Chorus Line right here in Boston.
Okay, so read to us what happened.
All right. Sitting by myself in the dark of a near-empty matinee in a theater near Government Center, Boston, I started to ugly cry. This is while watching the film. Full-on, grotesque, racking sobs during What I Did for Love, the kind where you're sort of gulping for air. As all these actors and singers and dancers were longing and yearning to act and sing and dance, I felt a kinship in my heart which lunged towards the screen as if it would burst. I stepped out of the theater, tears drying on my cheeks, into one of the most beautiful sunsets I'd ever seen. Red and orange light was streaming through snowflakes that had begun to quietly fall from the Boston sky. The ground, the multiplex, the high-spired churches and offices of that great city were being dusted with white, and time, once again, seemed to slow down and stop like a train pulling into a station. I gazed up into the sky and took several deep breaths, noticing that a deeply calm, passionate decision seemed to be dropping down into my body. I decided to go for it. I knew I had to become an actor. There was no turning back. It was my calling, my vocation. The entire course of my life changed outside of a multiplex during Christmas of 1985 after viewing one of the worst movies of the 1980s. True story.
That's actor Rainn Wilson reading from his memoir, The Bassoon King. When I got to that page, I just thought, we have to have him read this because this is one of the moments that you talk about in the book of letting yourself accept some kind of divine inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
Did it feel divine at the time?
You know, there's several of these moments. It's an interesting exercise to write one's memoir. I firmly believe everyone should do it because it gives you an incredibly valuable perspective. And you look back on my 49 years and I see these waypoints, these little special little hinge moments that without which I wouldn't have the life that I have. It all adds up to something, but there are these turning points. Did they feel divine at the time? I don't know. Sometimes they certainly didn't seem as profound as looking back on them, I realize they were.
Well, so I keep mentioning divinity, but we should explain that you're a member of the Baha'i faith.
Mm-hmm.
And that you have been since you were born, right?
Yeah, my parents.
But you've come in and out of it, though.
Exactly. My parents were Baha'is. I grew up Baha'i, was raised Baha'i, and was very into it as a kid and as a teen. And it was great because I learned all these wonderful teachings of the Baha'i faith, the equality of men and women and the unity of the races of humanity, the essential harmony of the world's religions, the harmony of science and religion, you know, these great teachings. But when I moved to New York City to become an actor, like right after what I just read there, I rejected it all. And I didn't want anything to do with faith, religion, God, morality. And it was about 12 years I was really outside of the Baha'i faith or any faith. And so a big through line in the book is my spiritual journey and finding my way back to the Baha'i faith.
Yeah. So, I mean, in the portion where when you rejected it all, I mean, that part actually kind of reads like a classic Hollywood fall from grace almost.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, cocaine played a role.
Yeah. It's like any VH1 Behind the Music, you know, when the band falls apart after their initial success.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hadn't even had any success and I fell apart. Yeah, I went off the rails in a lot of different ways back then. Yeah, and it wasn't like hardcore. It's not like, oh, I was this heroin addict, and it's not that story. It's not that kind of total addiction story, but it was, you know, I got lost in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's go back even further, if we could, to when you grew up, when you were really, really young, growing up in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that part spoke to me, too, because I grew up in Oregon. I'm a native Northwesterner.
Nice. Well.
Although I've been living here in Boston for a while, so I don't know what that makes me. But your parents weren't exactly down the middle, conventional 1960s, 70s parents, were they?
No, they weren't. They lived on a houseboat in Seattle, very bohemian kind of lifestyle, painting murals. And my mom was actually an actress in experimental theater in Seattle in the late 60s. And yeah, it was a very odd upbringing. After she left, my parents got a divorce, and I ended up living in Nicaragua for several mm-hmm. years. On the Caribbean coast, and had a lot of crazy misadventures there. So, you know, the long story short of it, looking back on it, is I'm a kind of an odd dude, but I really have played all these outsider characters that are alienated, kind of misfits. And because I relate to that so much, I really was an alienated misfit in so many different ways growing up.
Right. So, I mean, there's and it's your parents' sort of approach to the world didn't come out of anywhere, didn't come out of nowhere either. I mean, because you write how your mother's mother died,
yeah,
and her father was a farmer, and so she spent a lot of time growing up with chickens and pigs, like,
yeah,
while her dad was off working on the farm. And
yeah,
then your father's mother died because she was in a sanatorium, and she was trying going to visit her kids, but
it's the most tragic story I've ever heard in my
hit
life.
Hit her head and just died.
She had tuberculosis. She got better from tuberculosis. She had been in a sanatorium for years, and my dad was like 9 years old, and they went to go pick her up to take her home, and she ran over to see them out the window in the courtyard, and then she ran to go get her coat and leave, and fell down and hit her head on a radiator, and died. Just like that.
And your dad was what, 8?
I think he was 8 or 9 years old.
And yeah, you write that he sort of sits at the table afterwards and asks his father, who's going to take care of me now?
Yeah, yeah, who's going to take care of me now?
And that's what it all comes down to.
That's the line, isn't it?
So I'm asking you about all of this. We're doing this, like, therapy session here because...
I know, this is very deep. I love it.
Well,
this is good.
You're the one who gave me the material
all right
in the book. But
fair enough.
Because, you know, I keep having to remind myself as I was reading this, this is the guy who is a world-famous actor who plays a character or played a character on TV for a couple hundred episodes that's, like, the opposite of
uh-huh
all of this. You know...
But I can be a big fat jerk face, too. Just watch. Just wait. Ask my wife.
We have 6.5 more minutes for you to prove that here.
Okay.
Not that I'm challenging you to do that. But were there parts of this sort of unorthodox upbringing that did make its way into Dwight, the character?
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the reminiscences that I have, I don't even think I talked about it in the book so much, is I have this realization that because things were so odd in my family, with my stepmom who kind of raised me and my dad and my birth mother, that I didn't know how normal people acted. So I spent a lot of time in my childhood and in my teens trying to figure out how normal people related to one another. It was this kind of very kind of oddly detached, almost like how an android would kind of be watching human beings, or an alien posing as a human being, like, oh, these people are friends and they're happy. Oh, and look, and they hug in a carefree, jovial way. And they embrace and they laugh. And
does not compute.
Yeah. No. And no, I would take notes and be like, oh, that's what I should do. Next time I would see someone I like, I would try and laugh jovially and embrace in a similar way that I saw other people do it. Because my family was so odd that So it does relate to Dwight. I mean, because Dwight kind of does that too. He doesn't obey the rule. There's the Schrute rules of human interaction are very, very different than the normal cultural rules of human interaction.
Hmm. But on the other hand, you did write in the book that it was really interesting for you that you go from, I mean, you write about how in your teen years you are like a classic nerd, right? The bassoon playing the chess club.
Chess team, baby.
Chess
we competed.
Playing the bassoon because your teacher told you it would be better than playing the saxophone. All these things that make you a card-carrying nerd.
Yep, Dungeons and Dragons, sure.
Of course, we had to get the role-playing in there. But you write that you go from being that to a couple decades later being this like hero, this nerd hero. And in the book you say it's an exhilarating, that realization was exhilarating and incredibly challenging at the same time.
Yeah.
So the challenging part.
Yeah. So for someone who always considered themselves an outsider and kind of a weirdo, and I was just trying to make it as a character actor, and all of a sudden to just like wherever I went, people would be like, oh, my God, look, it's Dwight. Oh, hey, it's Dwight. I love you. Oh, my God, you're so funny. Can I have my picture? You're amazing. Oh, you know, to get that like wherever I go. Right. Not wherever, but a lot of places where I go. And especially back when the show was on the air, is pretty weird. It's a very strange, and it's like it's exciting. You know, I'd worked for 14 years as a professional actor before I did The Office. Hardly ever got recognized ever, and then to kind of be put on this weird pedestal was pretty astonishing. And it's challenging. Why? Because, man, it's so easy to get entitled. It's so easy. The human ego is a very insidious creature inside of us that wants attention and accolade and status, and there's a constant wrestling with ourselves we have to do. And when everyone is just giving you everything, just like, here's free stuff, or here, do you want a free trip? And we love you wherever you go. Like, you start to believe the hype. And it's not like I was like this raging jerk face, but well, sometimes I was. But it shifts your perspective in these insidious ways. Fame and entitlement.
And celebrity, yeah. And that, I mean, Hollywood, yeah. you use the phrase spiritually questionable, right? I mean.
Yeah. And so it's been a struggle, you know? That's been a battle. And think about, you know, the Justin Biebers of the world, or the people that are just, that get instantly famous and they're like 16 and the entire world is giving them on a platter.
Yeah.
You know, I have to constantly remind myself, like, look, I'm just this dorky Dungeons and Dragons playing actor from Seattle, and I happened to get lucky and get on this one TV show that got hot for a while.
Well, it was more than luck, because obviously your skill as an actor helped a great deal. But we've got like 30 seconds left, and I know it goes by fast, but I do want to just read a little bit from the last chapter of your book, because your spirituality and your faith play such a huge role here. The last chapter is 10 Things I Know for Sure. And it starts with number one, the deepest happiness comes from service to others, to number 10, which is, I still don't know anything.
True.
After all that time, still don't know anything.
Yeah, I'm gonna start over. I'm gonna write my next memoir of the next 50 years. Maybe I'll learn something.
Well, we'll have you back hopefully before 50 years goes by.
Okay. That's bassoon and playing in the background.
Yes, it is.
In fact, you did that for me.
We think about it all, actually.
Rainn Wilson is best known for his Emmy Award-nominated role as Dwight Schrute on NBC's The Office. He spoke with Meghna Chakrabarty about his memoir, The Bassoon King, My Life in Art, Faith, and Idiocy, in 2015.
I'm Tiziana
Deering. For today.
This is Radio Boston.
Radio Boston is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Sitterick, Paris Alston, Jamie Bologna, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we hope you'll join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston. You have probably heard somewhere, sometime, that every vote counts. Well, we found out in Boston this week, it sure does. In a recount on Monday afternoon, Boston City Council candidate Julia Mejia edged out her at-large opponent, Alejandra St. Guillen, by one vote. WBUR Simone Rios was in the room, and he joins us now from our bureau at the Dorchester Reporter. Simone, welcome.
Hey, nice to be here.
So this is like one of those incredible local moments in democracy, Simone. We know what happened, but you were there. How did it happen? How did that go down?
Yeah, cue the Hamilton music.
I know.
Where it happened. But, you know, just to put you in the scene a little bit, it's on the second floor of City Hall. The room was sort of offset below where people were standing. The recount area was cordoned off from everybody except the people involved. Probably 20 tables of people, one reading the results, another recording the results, then observers from each side making sure every vote was being counted accurately. And this thing went on from Saturday to Sunday and then into Monday, finally concluding Monday afternoon. And volunteers and campaign staffers and attorneys all looked pretty haggard by the end of it.
And it really didn't conclude kind of cleanly, Simone. Can you explain that? I mean, this is remarkable.
After the counting was done, a real feeling of tension overcame the room. Lawyers on both sides were advocating for their candidates. All 22 wards were in, everything was counted, and the two candidates were literally tied at 22,491 votes. But then it all came down to two ballots, one from a Brookline resident, somebody who had previously lived in Boston, moved to Brookline and cast a vote in Boston. And then the second was from a Boston resident who, I guess, voted in the wrong precinct. So the Boston Elections Commission only accepted the Boston resident's vote, and that just went in Mejia's favor.
So St. Guillen now loses by one vote. She could have challenged the recount through the courts, took about 24 hours to think about it, and decided not to. Do you know why she made that decision?
It really seemed like her campaign was leaning towards challenging after the recount. I got a call from her press person saying that they thought that she should have won by four votes and that they could take it to court. I put up one of those Twitter polls and only 51 people voted, but 71% thought St. Guillen should not take it to court.
Okay.
A guy named Jacques Jean on Twitter wrote that the reason for the tie is because the same people who voted for St. Guillen voted for Mejia, but that taking it to court would be pushing it too far. And then the next day she decided not to challenge. So yeah, I think she had to have made a political calculation about what a challenge might look like for her future. But then in the end, she congratulated Mejia and said she'll be proud to have Mejia's representing her on the council.
So we've got about a minute left. And I guess I want to ask, how do the two camps come together now? And will they, or is this going to leave some wounds?
I think it was difficult. You had a lot of people on either campaign. Boston's a small city, and it's a lot of political people who had worked together previously, that who all of a sudden were in this pitched battle for the fourth city council seat. So I guess it got pretty ugly at times. A lot of people who were friends ended up really pitted against each other. And now that it's over, I think a lot of people are hoping that folks will let bygones be bygones. But I got to say, there's probably some people who wish St. Guillen would have gone on and taken this to court.
That is WBUR Simone Rios. Simone, I appreciate you sharing it with us. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Pete Frates helped popularize the Ice Bucket Challenge, and he raised millions of dollars for ALS research. He has died of the disease. Frates was 34 years old. The Beverly native was a star athlete, first at St. John's Prep, then at Boston College. But as WBUR's Callum Borchers reports, Pete Frates made his greatest impact after ALS began to take a toll on his body.
Here's the number 9 hitter in the order.
Frates captained the BC baseball team with a powerful left-handed swing that, at times, looked a bit like Lou Gehrig's.
And that is hit high and deep. Jowers going back. Jowers launches it out of here. That's a grand slam home run for Peter Frates.
Frates wasn't Gehrig's equal on the field, but he may have matched the Hall of Famer in drawing attention to the disease they shared. It was Gehrig's diagnosis in 1939 and this famous speech at Yankee Stadium that put a largely unknown condition in the spotlight.
That I might have been given a bad break, but I've got an awful lot to live for.
Frady's adopted the same attitude as he battled what's often called Lou Gehrig's disease. It's a fatal neurological condition that slowly erodes muscle function. People with ALS lose the ability to speak, walk, and eventually breathe on their own. While Gehrig introduced many Americans to ALS, Frady's became a rainmaker, literally and figuratively. Here he is accepting an award for his advocacy from the ALS Therapy Development Institute. It was 2012, just 8 months after he was diagnosed.
For me, I'm going to hopefully capitalize on this and realize that this is a lot in life I've been given and be able to go forward and get you all the money and resources that you so deservedly need.
Frady's fundraising breakthrough came a couple of years later with this, a bucket of ice water. On Facebook in the summer of 2014, he challenged a mix of friends and celebrities, including Tom Brady and Julian Edelman, whose splash you just heard, to dump water on their heads or donate to the ALS Association to avoid getting cold and wet. Ultimately, the Patriots donated and staged a team dousing, led by owner Robert Kraft.
So on three, one, two, three.
Frady's didn't invent the ice bucket challenge. It's a fundraising gambit that philanthropy experts say has been around for a while. But Frady's connections in the sports world helped make it a viral sensation. Top athletes like LeBron James posted videos of their soakings on social media. So did Oprah, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, and Bill Gates.
I'm here to join the people bringing attention to Lou Gehrig's disease by taking the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge.
Critics of the challenge said it could encourage something called slacktivism. Remember, the premise was anyone willing to get drenched didn't have to give any money, so participants could claim to be activists while slacking on the donations. But it turned out that a lot of people opened the icy floodgates and their wallets, too. Paul Shervish founded the Center on Wealth and Philanthropy at Frady's alma mater, Boston College. He says people like to feel that they're making a difference.
And that was what was going on in the Ice Bucket Challenge. When you got that dumped on you, that emphasized you were the actor, not the organization. And that is a major reversal in the understanding of fundraising that organizations need to learn.
Over 8 weeks in 2014, the Ice Bucket Challenge raised $115 million, according to the ALS Association. Most of the money went toward research. It even helped scientists discover a new gene that contributes to the disease. But as Frady's health inevitably worsened in recent years, he and his family turned their fundraising focus toward caring for patients with advanced ALS.
The care is just overwhelming.
That's Frady's mother, Nancy, in an online video for the Frady's Family Foundation, which earned nonprofit status in May. She says funding research is vital, but in the meantime, there are patients who need round-the-clock assistance.
The care versus cure is a debate that we have all the time in the ALS world, because the cure is probably going to be for those soon to be diagnosed. The care is for people who are living today with the disease.
Frady spoke openly about the demands his care placed on loved ones, especially his wife Julie, who now must raise their young daughter without him. Through his family's foundation, part of Frady's legacy will be helping to ease the burden on other families by paying for medical equipment, home health aides, and similar expenses.
That was WBUR's Callum Borchers, reflecting on the life and legacy of Pete Frady's. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.